Genesis 18. This is the reading for Tammuz 2. Would anybody like to know how far behind we are?
6 weeks.
Yes.
Then maybe we can't go to Tamar.
No. We have 3 years to catch up. 2.5
years. Actually, 2.5.
Two and a half.
2 and a third. In the ninth month.
Remember the oak of Mamre that we studied back a little while? Go back to chapter 13 a minute.
We'll come back to it.
Oh, yeah. This is where Abram built a
altar. Unto the Lord.
But was it one of those altars that God just kind of thumbed his nose at, or was it? Yeah, it was a temporary altar. It was a high, in spirit, it's a high place. Every time there's an altar built that isn't in Jerusalem, it's an indicator that it's a high place activity.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
I thought it was...
But it says you're in the plains.
Yeah, but it's, right. No, the word is bad translation. It should be the oak, under the oak of Mamre. It's a oak tree. Okay, anyway, back to 18. And the Lord appeared unto him in the plains or oak of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. Now, this will be the seventh, I think, appearance of God to Abraham. He's going to eventually appear to Abraham 10 times. Now, this is the sixth, I'm sorry, of 10 appearances. Abraham had been living here 20 years.
How long since he first heard of the promise?
Exactly, in a moment. A small moment. Again, he had been in Canaan 24 years. It had been 39 years since he left Ur. It's been 13 years since the Lord last visited him, besides the one that just happened with the circumcision. 24 years since the promise was first made. He still doesn't own anything. Nothing of the promise has yet come to pass.
He's 99
years old. And this is now 20 years that he's been living in this place. 24 years he's been waiting. This is why we read this stuff. What?
Faster.
All right, are you sure?
Yeah, I am sure.
What do you know?
Because none of us have waited 24 years for anything.
I've waited 18.
It's not
24. Pretty close.
Well, we'll hope something happens within the next 6.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Huh? God hadn't spoken to him in, what was it, 12 years?
13.
Sorry, I didn't agree.
But to me, it's like, is he like keeping feasts and doing things like that in the meantime?
Because there was no feast to keep because he was. There's all kinds of stuff written in the Talmud, the Mishnah, about this. That, especially, they think of the Bible, the Torah, is really about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, the Genesis is really about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's all it's about. Everything that led up to Abraham was just getting in preparation for Abraham. But they say that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were the Torah incarnate. Torah meaning law. How can that which is about Genesis, which is almost, there's no law in it, how can the whole thing be called Torah? Well, it's because those men, it was Torah incarnate. Therefore, they had no need for the things of the flesh, because they were the promise. Now, if you could see it, that's the same. Since Christ completed it all, the law and everything in it, then we are now ourselves Torah incarnate. You understand? Torah incarnate just means Torah in meat. In us. Now, again, the rabbis said that the Lord appeared unto Abraham 10 times because that was the number that was required for a synagogue until before there could be true revelation. And so the completion of the 10 times to Abraham meant that in effect he was his own synagogue because of those 10 appearances. Cool. He was his own minion, do you understand?
Which is really why he could be the progenitor.
That's right. Okay. And sat in the heat in the tent door in the heat of the day. In the heat of the day, the word is, he was noon. That's what it meant. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. Now, they lived in the same kind of tents that the Bedouin tribesmen live in now. In fact, the Bedouin are the closest genetically there are in the world today to both Abraham and to Jesus Christ.
So, Jesus is not blue-eyed, fair-haired.
No. The Bedouin tents, remember when we studied in... In the Song of Solomon that we were supposed to read at Passover, which we didn't read last Passover, that the tents that she is compared, the bride is compared in beauty to the tents of Kedar. Now, if you've ever been to the Middle East and seen these tents, they're just awful. They're flaps of skin that they didn't have canvas in. They were skin, and still the more expensive ones still are. They're flaps of skin to provide insulation from the heat. And then several of the inner flaps are moistened so that there's some natural air conditioning. But they're real ugly from outside. But you go inside the tents and it's like you're in a different world. It's the incredible jewels and fancy silks that Kedar, the tribe who are of Ishmael... They are all, they're famous for these, the Bedouin tents. And the things that are in the tents have been passed down for generations, some of them claiming back to this time. They're passed down by tribe, by family, they're honored objects. And they're just, they're awesome. And in the summer, in the heat of the day, it's customary that they set up this, the tent flap is about as big as this room. The flap that comes over, and it's normally on. It's what they call a flap is normally on open only on one end. I mean, the bedrooms in the tent are back in here, but the tent flap comes down and it's closed on three sides, and then one end it's open. But it's customary. I mean, they compel you to come in to supper. I mean, it's the highest honor there to have the most guests. I mean, it's like it still is today. Even in the terrible places like Beirut now, it's hospitality is they don't know strangers. Now here, it was they are said to eat and they eat their meal in the tent flaps so they can see any strangers and invite them into meal. Now he looked and he saw three men. Approaching. It says stood by him. They didn't like automatically appear. He knew they were there. They were there in the neighborhood. He ran to meet them from the tent door And then he got to them, and he bowed himself toward the ground. And it's a Hebrew word which means complete prostration of the body by falling on the knees and then gradually reclining the body until the head touches the ground. He saw three. He ran to meet them. Now watch what happens to the pronouns. And said, "My Lord, if now I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will fetch a morsel of bread, and comfort you, ye your hearts. After that you shall pass on, for therefore are you come to your servant." And they said, "So do as thou hast said." And Abraham hastened into the tent unto Sarah, and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes upon the hearth." And Abraham ran unto the herd and fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it unto a young man, and he hastened to dress it. And he took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed, and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. Now, tradition says this happened on Passover. In verse 3, he said, "My Lord," it's the word Adonai, it's sovereign. It's used as a proper name for God only. When Abraham first saw the men, he thought they were only men, but as he approached, he knew who he was, and he bowed and called him Adonai. He saw Jesus Christ. He saw Christ.
Is this just Christ or the Trinity?
It's the Trinity. In verse 3 also, "If I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away." Found is the word matzah. In other words, I can't explain this, but it's Abraham, in a sense, became the Nazarite vow at this moment. He didn't take bread or wine. He became only the servant. The one thing that we have forgotten on the Nazarite vow is the only reason we're doing it is so that you would be the broken bread and the poured out wine. I'm so sick of the little complaints about it. You see the men approaching. You approach them. You see in the Spirit that they are Jesus Christ, and you serve them. You understand? If I have found favor in thy sight, matzah, if I have become the matzah, it's so sad to me that there's not one new person since the Nazarite vow started. I'm going to talk a lot about this Sunday. There's no one that has brought anybody. Huh? Yeah, but that wasn't... No, he didn't. Nobody brought him. He appeared. I can't believe, of all the preaching and of all the screaming and yelling I did about you becoming the broken bread and the poured out wine, the closest one we have to bringing, to someone becoming a part of us as a result of us being in the Nazarite vow is Tony Natale. Now, I know it's hard to bring people to this. I mean, how in the world do you explain this to somebody? But it isn't hard to invite people to lunch or to supper. And it's sick that it hasn't been used by all of you. 100% more. That's the closest we can experience in terms of physical things of offering the peace offering to someone. Mike, you understand me?
Yeah.
Now, I want you, the lesson of tonight, in this lesson of Abraham, is I want you to see that this sense of hospitality. Abraham was encouraged, that's the flap of our tent. The first time that the very first time since I've known Ed Housewright, he was real with his parents as a result of inviting them under the flap of the tent. I beg of you, see it. Argue with me if you don't agree. By your silence, you're a witness against yourself. You want to make your job interesting? Start saying who you are at your job.
I know who I am. I think I'm ridiculous, Sergeant.
Yeah, it's really funny when you bring up stuff about the vow. It's really like...
Well, you don't have to. The vow is nothing.
You talk about that, and you talk about why you're doing it, and there's so much fascination, and then it's like, well, you know, do you want to come to dinner with us? And it's sort of...
I mean, if you can't take someone to lunch, that's obscene.
No, I'm not saying that I can't take someone to lunch. I'm telling you that there's a certain hesitation about coming to something that sounds so eccentric.
Well, that's, you know that no one in the universe has ever rejected Jesus Christ? They've only rejected caricatures of him painted by very poor artists. What are you telling them? Of course, if you tell them off the wall things about the vow, they'll think you're crazy. You introduce them to the whole, to the...
You know, it's just like what you're talking about Isaac the other night, though. I mean, there are lots of times where, you know, you are a bad act, no matter how real it is to you or how clear it is to you, it somehow comes across as a bad act.
You understand? That it matters not? I'm talking about even making the effort.
Her eyes are rolling, like, oh, God, you know, you're into it again. So,
so I felt real free with picking Laura, but and she said she would, you know, I invited her and she said she would come, but there wasn't the same. Like when Kindred hearing us brothers came tonight, you know, I know who we are, we don't really, it's no big deal. But it wasn't anything that was said, but when Beth walked in the door with her baby, Andrew, Beth's brother, something struck him, something really deep, and I don't even, you know, he never really talked about it, but his eyes filled with tears, and he just was, you know, just the whole scene of us being there and Beth being there with the baby, and all, you know, just the whole thing that was not something that you could tell someone about or anything. I mean, it just, I know he was moved, incredibly moved by the whole experience of just being there.
I see what you mean, though. I mean, like, I've invited, well, especially, like, my roommate, my ex-roommate, that he wouldn't come, but it was nice to be able, I mean, a lot of people, you could say, hey, come to our Bible study, but by the time they're ready to come to your Bible study, it's, you know, that's so much further down the road than, yeah, I'll come meet you again. But he didn't make me up on it, which, you know, that was too bad. It is a real luxury to have. It's like the one feast of the year that you can bring an outsider to, which is also a culture shock, you know, to come to bring them into a feast.
Well, I had a new... She's a copywriter for the agency. This morning that I had a meeting at PSA, and she met me at the office, and we were going down the elevator, and she said, what did you do this weekend? You know, and I told her about what we'd all done over the weekend, about work from the house. And we really didn't talk about the NASA right now, but, you know, in the past, I've had some apprehensions about the school, you know, because, you know, I was raised in this family of, my mother worked for the school system, and so I always was in on all the school system stuff, so I was a little bit apprehensive about it. And I found myself telling her about, you know, what we, you know, modeled at the First Century Church and celebrating the Jewish feasts, and I started talking about the school, and I got, it was really weird, I was all excited telling her about the school and everything the kids were learning. We painted the rooms, and she was like, just looking at me like, my God, what are you doing? But at the same time, she took it real well. I mean, she was like, oh, that's really neat. You know, and I talked about, you know, just some of the different stuff. And we briefly touched on the NASA right now, but it was the first person that, you know, that I've told it something to that somebody has reacted without going, oh, God, you know, what are you doing, whatever. But it was, you know, I mean, this is really selfish, but it was really neat to be able to tell, to be so excited about the school and everything that the kids were doing and learning, you know, due to the fact that I'd had this apprehensiveness before.
What happens when, most of you have been to a quote-unquote regular church, and they have this moment of where everybody turns around and smiles and shakes hands,
fellowship moment, or whatever they call it.
And then at the end of the if you're a visitor, you raise your hand, and at the end of the time, somebody, say if some kind of committee comes up and talks to you, and it's so awkward, you just feel like an idiot. Because it's not real. It's not love. It's somebody's definition of what love is. There's only one thing that will attract anyone to what we are. Everybody go there right now. John 13, verse 34. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this shall all know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another. Now what is love that anyone could see? All we know about is what it isn't. You know why Tony comes here so often? and why he brings other people from over here. He brings them over here so that they can see love. Now to us, it's crazy. I mean, we get in fights all the time and I'm yelling, screaming at everybody. It just seems like life. But to Tony and to the people that he brings them here because he sees love here. He sees true from the heart action, activity, interaction with people. You forget how rare this is. Now, you know what? The biggest thing that one of the times that somebody that he brought remembered is the deal when I told the kid, two kids, or Tom and Darlene's kids, that if they cried, they had to leave the restaurant. And they instantly stopped crying. And the guest said, you know, that's the best example of love I've ever seen. Now we didn't come about to be a showpiece for anybody. But we came about to be a place, a community that is alive. A people that is the opposite of death. Now, during the Nazarite vow, let's play this. Let's run this rabbit. Go to Matthew 11, verse 7. And as they departed, Jesus began to say unto the multitudes concerning John. Now remember, look how I look. Look how Harry looks. Okay? This is from a few days. John the Baptist right now is 30 years old, 30 plus. A razor has never touched his face or his hair. A razor or a scissors has never touched his beard. Can you imagine what he must have looked like? He was only one of three in the history of all of the world to be a Nazarite from birth. As they departed, Jesus began to say unto the multitudes concerning John, what went you out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken with the wind? But what went you out to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft clothing are in kings' houses. But what went you out really to see? A prophet. Yea, and I say unto you, and more than a prophet, for this is he of whom it is written, behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. And verily I say unto you, among them that are born of women, there hath not risen a greater than John the Baptist, notwithstanding he that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you will receive it, this is Elijah which was for to come. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. But, to the contrary, against all that, whereunto shall I liken this generation? It is like unto children sitting in the markets, and calling unto their fellows, and saying, we have piped unto you, and you have not danced. We are a people that walk not to the piping or dance to the piping of the world. We are proving it to ourselves by separating ourselves from the ridiculousness of the world. We are not piping to their music. We are marching to a different drummer. We are dancing to a different sound than they ever knew. But there are some in your world, I promise you, whose dance is halted, who are sick and tired and maimed and afraid. They are the ones that you compel to come into the feast. They are the ones that you compel to come in. Do you understand me? I'm not going to waste my time with some idiot that is going to make fun of this. I mean, who cares? I'm not going to waste my time trying to debate anymore or prove something to somebody. But I know, because I know that in each of your worlds there are needs. There are people that are dying. All I'm asking you to do is invite them to lunch. All I'm asking you to do is to expose them, that you might become one who disciples, so that you can get your eyes off of yourselves. So that you might know the joy of saying, I am fulfilled as I fulfill others. What happens to me is unimportant as long as I meet your need. Fox's lair, the tent flap, is simply an opportunity where you don't have to be embarrassed to ask someone to come and have lunch with you. You don't have to ask him to be a partaker of any doctrine or any weird thing that you think we are doing. The only way that you can progress any farther than you are at this moment is if you are responsible for a disciple. The rest of the learning will be as filthy rags unless that takes place in you. Unless someone becomes an inconvenience to you. Do you understand me? Where you have taken on their very salvation as your responsibility. Where you have said before God that you are a faithful proclaimer, or caller forth on the watchtower. Do you understand that I've heard every possible excuse? Do you understand that I've heard every possible argument? Do you understand those arguments they're less than a mosquito? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? I'm telling you, I'm not saying go save anybody for their benefit. I'm telling you, unless you have someone that you can disciple, you can go no further. You need them in order to be manifest with God. I've given you've been perfected perfectly. You've been equipped perfectly for the work of the ministry. Everything is laid out for you. But to sit I promise you, unless it begins to be outpoured massively, this group of people will be in the same position spiritually as in tonight naturally. You have taken in, you've eaten too much You haven't been able to, you're constipated. Everything is wrong with your digestive system. The nutrients aren't getting where they should. There's no process of osmosis because there's only self-seeking internally. The only way someone will know when they see is by our love one for another. The only way love is seen is in community. There's a whole world out there trying by their churches to have love as an isolated self. It can't happen. Invite them into your tent flap. The ones that are in need, compel them to come in. I promise you, every one of them is in need. You just haven't learned the surgery to explode their myth yet. Verse 3, and he said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. Let's go to Luke. Chapter 7. One of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment.
Oh, we have hers. Yeah.
37.
Now in 38. Thanks. And stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with her tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with ointment, or perfume. Now when the Pharisee which had bidden him saw it, he spoke within himself, saying, This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said unto him, Simon, I have somewhat to say unto thee. And he saith, Master, say on. There was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed 500 pence, and the other 50. When they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most? Simon answered and said, I suppose that he to whom he forgave most. And he said unto him, Thou hast rightly judged. And he turned to the woman and said unto Simon, Seest thou this woman? I entered into thine house, and thou gavest me no water for my feet. But she hath washed my feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman, since the time I came in, hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And he said unto her, Thy sins are forgiven. And they that sat at meat with him began to say within themselves, Who is this that forgiveth sins also? And he said unto the woman, Thy faith has saved thee, go in peace. Well, some say that woman was Mary Magdalene. But feet washing is pretty wild. In scriptures it says that it's the duty of the wife to the husband. It's the duty of the son to the father. from son to the master. The qualification to accept an aged widow into the camp was that she would be one who washes the apostles' feet. What in the hell does that mean? Why here? Why here in Genesis now? This is the first time we've seen foot washing in the Bible. What does it mean? Why do we have so little of it? Whereas you read the New Testament, it's throughout it. It's an example of service and humility and laying down your life one for another. Is it just cultural? I doubt it. Is it because you feel awkward trying to do it? In Tara's hot seat, she had to wash everybody in the room's feet. Except one wouldn't let her. She washed him with her tears, literally. What is it about foot washing that's so weird?
It's a sign of complete willingness to be a servant.
Let's go to John 13. John 13. Tradition has it that this occurrence took place on Passover. And it was the antitype of what we're about to see now on Passover. Remember the Haggadah reading? I've got it here somewhere. Just a minute. The power of thy mighty deeds didst thou show forth wondrously in Passover. Chief of all festivals did thou exalt the Passover. Thou didst reveal to Abraham the Ezrahite the events of the midnight of Passover. Thou didst wrap its doors during the heat of the day on Passover. He gave bright angels a meal of matzah cakes on the Passover. He ran to the cattle as a hint of Joseph the ox who will bring about the Passover. Anyway, and that next the people of Sodom were treated to God's wrath and were consumed in fire on a Passover. Lot escaped from their midst and baked matzah at the end of a Passover. Egypt's lands of... Anyway, you know that one. Tradition says that this and the previous meeting with God occurred on Passover. Isaac cannot be born. It's impossible for the promise to come forth until Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. Just as it was impossible for Egypt to partake of the Passover, they had to have the plagues come upon them in order that Israel could escape from Egypt, so that the seed could escape from the world at the time of Passover. The same is true for you. Sodom is about to be destroyed on Passover. But none of it happened before the foot washing took place. Isaac, the promise can't come forth unless there's first the foot washing. And Sodom and Gomorrah can't be destroyed unless first there's the foot washing. What kind of mystery could be locked up in that? Jesus Christ couldn't be crucified unless first there was the foot washing. The Passover, his Passover from time couldn't take place unless there was the foot wash. Better look into this foot washing business. Now, before the Feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, John 13, and that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. And supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he was come from God, and he went to God. He riseth from supper, and laid aside his garments, and took a towel, and girded himself. He poureth water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. And cometh he unto Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said unto him, What I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. Peter said unto him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. And Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Simon Peter said also unto him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. And Jesus saith unto him, He that is washed needeth not, save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit. And you are clean, but not all. For he knew he should betray him. Therefore he said, You are not all clean. So after he had washed their feet and taken his garments and was set down again, he said unto them, Know you what I have done to you? You call me Master and Lord, and you say, Well, for I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, or a type, that you should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. You all know that your lifetime of trying to become king of the doesn't work. God is now saying to you that the promise can't be revealed in you, that Sodom and Gomorrah can't be destroyed, that the world can't be destroyed, that Christ can't be crucified, therefore he can't be resurrected, unless you do them in you.
Is it the giving?
The washing of your feet. The laying down of your life. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither is he that sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. You know, there's some of you in here that you'll wash feet at the drop of a hat. Some of you who wouldn't even consider it because it's so against the naturalness in you. You would only even consider it if you were convinced in your head by some that it wouldn't be some liturgical deed. Well, I'm telling you that foot washing is impossible as a liturgy. It's too humiliating. That's a good place to stop. There's only one place in the scriptures where the people were commended for anything. In Acts 17, the people of Berea were commended. because they searched the scriptures daily to see if the things that Paul talked about were true. And then every one of them was fully persuaded in his own mind, so he would have rejoicing in himself and not in another. That's the other thing that happens. The only time most of you open a Bible is when you're here. That's ludicrous. You want me to spoon feed it to you? Well, that was okay for a time. That's not okay anymore. Search the scriptures daily to see whether these things be true. Then shall you have rejoicing in yourself and not in another. You won't have to worry about whether or not somebody, I mean, you will know that you know that you know. Amen?
Amen.
Take it, big guy.